I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu, and I'm back again with another edition of Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network, and I have James Nestor with me. And I believe a bunch of out there might have, if you don't know James by name, you know the book Breath, which he put out. When did this come out? A year ago or so,
James? About a year ago in May, yep.
But happy to have you here, James, and as I said before we got on, this book is a revelation. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I should tell you, though, this is interesting. I got the tip to even look at this or even know about this book from Ram Dass's Chinese medicine doctor in Maui, who really kept him going for 15 years. I called him because I had suddenly a little bit of an elevated blood pressure count. And I really respect him. Whenever I'm in Maui, I see him. His name is Malik Cotter. And he said, start breathing. Just do this simple thing. In breath and out breath, counting, you know, as long as you can, you know, from deep diaphragm, and do it for 5 minutes a few times a day. I'm telling you. And there's a book called Breath. Get it. That's it. So I got the book and I started doing the exercise. The book was on a shelf because, you know, I've got a lot of books that I'm trying to deal with. And it was another book. It was that kind of a thing. And then it was very invigorating in the beginning, but then I was falling off the regularity of it. And it just sort of dissipated. And then I'm passing by and I go, wait, that's Malik's book that he told me to read. So I picked it up and then I went, okay, hang on a second here. My whole perspective was completely unfocused, shall we say. And I reached out to your people representing you and said, hey, I would love to do a podcast here. This is something else. So that's how it all came about. Then as I started going through it, it's something that I really wanted to share with everybody who follows us on Be Here Now Network. So again, thank you. And that's the genesis of how I came. You know, it's thank you, Malik.
Well, thanks for having me. And I will just say that I had the same exact experience that you had, but years previously, because I had no experience in breath work. I had never written about a breathing before. And so to find all this stuff out from one step to the other, to talk to one person leads you to the other, that's just what I did for more than 5 years. So that process of discovery, it's interesting to hear how you just had it, the short version, but yeah, that's exactly the journey that I was on while writing this as a journalist.
Yeah. And you weren't feeling tip top, right? I mean, obviously it's in the book, but that did push you.
Well, yeah, I was following everything that I thought was right. I was exercising constantly. I was surfing, doing martial arts, walking a lot, riding my bike, and I was sleeping 8 hours a night, but I wasn't breathing correctly. And I didn't know that. And I was having these constant respiratory issues. I was having pneumonia, mild pneumonia, year in and year out. My doctor would give me a pack of antibiotics and say, you'll be fine. but after so many years, I said, something just feels a little off about this. And that's what really got me interested in this subject, was that my own personal experience of having this thing that we carry around with us all day long, our entire lives, and yet few of us ever consider that we get most of our energy from our breath, that our breath dictates our heart rate in so many ways, and that it's, breathing is what feeds our body more than the food and drink we ingest.
Yeah. And of course, many people who listen to this podcast and the other podcasts on Be Here Now Network around consciousness and are familiar with pranayama, and they're familiar with that practice enhancing our ability to assimilate molecules of consciousness, shall we say, and gradually move in a direction of becoming a little bit freer of the stuff that holds us down. And the way that you have integrated, as I also said before we got on, the reality that one is, of course, like what Malik said to me, start doing this breathing thing and you'll bring your blood pressure, just a simple thing, completely on that level. And then years in the past number of years, I was seeing a teacher in India who very much emphasized pranayama. So it started to come, and that's the other side of it. So to grab these two pieces and have them have the realization of how integrated they are, and the way in which, of course, you point them out in the book, going back so far, and how the Tibetans and were so, the whole idea of tummo, which is creating heat in the body to withstand being able to be in cold, is pretty amazing. Go ahead.
These were just variations on the same theme that were developed in different cultures at different times, and they were named different things. But when you start breaking them down, which is what I did, I had all of these different pieces of paper on my office wall and was looking at what they were asking us to do. So much of pranayama has you breathe very vigorously and then hold your breath, or to breathe very slowly and then to breathe very vigorously. I mean, what is Kundalini breathing? That's exactly what it is. The same thing happens in Qigong, and the same thing happens in other breathing practices throughout the world. And so, I don't think it's a coincidence that all these cultures develop these different technologies of breathing. I think they did this through research and finding out what works. And what's great now is we have scientific instruments to measure what happens when you breathe in a certain way, measure what happens to your brain, to your heart, to your blood pressure, to your metabolism. And that's what's so exciting about all of this to me as a science journalist, is it's no longer just subjective. Hey, you breathe this way, you feel better. Okay, great. It's objective. We can see this with data. And if we're able to see something with data, we're able to use it across populations, which is exactly what's happening right now.
Yeah, amazing. I guess we should get to the premise, although you touched on it, but just reading from your book, our capacity to breathe has changed through the long processes of human evolution. And the way we breathe has gotten markedly worse since the dawn of the industrial age. And that, we'll go into that, because that's amazing too. they discovered that 90% of us, very likely me, you, and almost everyone you know, is breathing incorrectly, and that this failure is either causing or aggravating a laundry list of chronic disease. Anybody out there need another reason to read this book? I mean, I can't more highly recommend it. And by the way, one great thing, James, is that at the end of the book, you put an appendix or something with practice. And, you know, and I think you have some on your website, which we'll get that all into the show notes as well. But let's go back, though, to, I mean, you talk about traditions like Shiva Swarodhaya. Right? From your book. I mean, how did you find that at all? I know you did a lot of research on this, so, but still.
Well, I kept digging, and I thought I had this story pretty well figured out. So in nonfiction, what you do is submit a book proposal, which is about 50 or 60 pages. And that's what you sell to publishers. And they give you a little modicum of money, just enough to stay really hungry, to go out and write the book. So I did that. I spent 6 months on this proposal. And then once I got really deeply into this field of research, I had to throw everything out and start again. Once I realized that humans do not evolve in a straight line of progress. No life form evolves in a straight line of progress. Evolution is not about survival of the fittest or getting stronger and better every year, living longer. Look what's happened to our species in the past 300 years. So this is what I was told by biological anthropologists. I said, what are you talking about? You know, I went to college. I learned about evolution. They're like, yeah, I think you learned just a small part of evolution, not the full story. So if you just taking, for instance, looking at the human mouth, what's happened to our mouths in 300 years, our ancestors had universally straight teeth. They had these huge sinus cavities. They had these huge jaws. They had these gorgeous pronathic faces. 90% of the population today has crooked teeth. Why do we have crooked teeth? Because our mouths have grown so small that our teeth no longer fit. Smaller mouth, more difficulty in breathing. So this is not controversial, and yet so few people have ever heard about it. All you have to do is look at ancient skulls, look at their mouths, look at their teeth, and then look in the mirror and see what you see. Because, you know, our ancestors didn't have their wisdom teeth taken out. They didn't need to. Their mouths were big enough. So once I realized that, I said, oh my God, there is this whole other story here that I need to start digging into. And that's what I did for several years.
Yeah, before we get into the Shiva Swarodhaya, since you talked about this change that's gone on through basically, actually, you start with farming, when farming changed everything, right? And it changed how the way that people ate. And that was a big deal right there and then in terms of evolution. It's crazy to me, though, how that would make a very negative change. I don't understand that.
Well, you know, evolution doesn't have a set point. It's not always moving towards something. I mean, is it an advantage that chickens don't fly anymore? I don't think so. Is it an advantage that ostriches don't fly? Is it an advantage to humans to have 20% of us suffer from asthma and 50% of us snore and 20% of us suffer from sleep apnea and, you know, 60% of the U.S. population be overweight and 40% be obese? There's no advantage to any of that. 15% of the population has diabetes. I think it's even more than that. So that is not going to allow us to exist longer and to be stronger and better. Lifespan, actually, a few years ago was decreasing. Even with all the latest medical advancements, lifespan was starting to decrease. So, you know, this sounds controversial right at the beginning, but all you have to do is open up an anthropology book, open up a book on evolution, what evolution really is, how it really functions. And it's all clearly placed there. We've been force-fed this survival of the fittest Darwinism, you know, tied into capitalism for some reason. And that's what we know of evolution, but that's simply not how it works. And the evidence is all over the world, all the time. You can see it for yourself. Mm.
We have some evidence going last year of something or other now, don't we? This pandemic. My God.
Well, it's nature's batting last, yeah. Right? We think that we've outsmarted everything. Oops, sorry. Mm. Doesn't quite work that way. So this is a real resetting of the world, I hope. You know, it's been a horrendous year, and hopefully we'll learn something off the back end of this.
And I would say some of the practices that are in this book, the practical practices of breathing correctly, or using different methods, again, that are not just for improving health, but therefore improving one's field of consciousness, you can't lose. And I think that these practices directly related to what's the biggest thing, COVID, is you lose the ability to breathe. So I have to think, I mean, you must have thought that this book was finished before COVID, right? No.
You know, I got, this was finished so long before ever entered the scene. I laugh because the book came out in May of last year, 2020, right? COVID really started booting up in March. And right when the book came out, you know, some people were just like, oh, very convenient. You wrote this book real quick and published it to come out during a respiratory pandemic. This book was signed, sealed, done in September of 2019. That's how long it takes books to come out. So it was in catalog 6 months beforehand. So the fact that it happened to come out, you know, 7 weeks into a pandemic that affected the respiratory system at a time when people started considering their breathing is just the most cosmic coincidence. And, you know, nobody planned this. This was a book I worked on for years and years and years. But, you know, I think that humans, as a modern humans, we are reactionary. So it's only when things get so bad do we decide to do something about it. You can look at climate change as a great example. There's been signs of this for the last 50 years. Right now, we're starting to barely do something about it. But, you know, when we're losing the ability to breathe, we say, huh, maybe I should think about my breathing a little more often. Maybe I should take care of that. So that's certainly what's happened in this last year, at least from what I've seen.
There's probably direct practices in here for anybody who had COVID, or I don't even think you need that, but certainly there's some direct correlations that can help. So,
yeah, the great thing is that so many doctors right now, there's an organization called Stasis, which is formed by a bunch of doctors and other people in the medical community to educate doctors on patients who have COVID, how to breathe during COVID, because they noticed something with the vast majority of people who were suffering from extreme symptoms of COVID. Their breathing was completely messed up. And it was probably messed up before they even got it. So we know that breathing practices can have a significant impact on to help your recovery with COVID. I'm not saying they're going to do everything for you. I would never say that. But they can only help. You lose your ability to engage your diaphragm when you're on a ventilator, okay? You lose like 50% of your muscle mass after a week. You need to restore that. Antibiotics aren't the only things you need. You need to restore the pathway through which you bring in air, because we get most of our energy for air. So it seems so simple, and yet this is not something the larger medical community has been considering is how we breathe. They've been considering that we're breathing. As long as you're breathing, you're okay. But yeah, it's right. How you breathe.
Yeah. So although you, of course, did a lot of scholarly work here, you also went into the field, and we love stories here. And this part of the book is like, boy, you could have a movie just around this part. It's macabre and it's haunted. It's going to Paris. Can you tell that story? Because after you went through this whole thing and realized, okay, this change over the last 300 years of people and how their physiognomy, is that the right word, changed. Their jaws changed. Their whole everything changed in that sphere of time to create some really bad, bad problems. When you talk about what people looked like in the industrial age in terms of their crooked jaws, and, you know, Dickinsonian kind of stuff that you would see in one of those dark movies. So you went to Paris.
Yeah, this was more the beginning of when I really started getting into this research. And this was before I was able to get into labs to look at ancient human skulls in the top laboratories, one of which is at the Morton Collection at the University of Pennsylvania. So this was before that, when I was in Paris and I had heard that there were 6 million human specimens below the streets of Paris. Some people might know what I'm talking about. It's called the catacombs. That's the sanctioned tour for tourists. But there are about 170 other miles of quarries beneath the streets of Paris. That's how they dug up all that limestone. They dug up the stone from 60 feet below and then brought it up. And that's what they built the Louvre with. That's what they built the Arc de Triomphe with, you know. And so with all the dead people, anyone who died in Paris, they would go and put them down in these quarries. So there were no guides down there. It was illegal to be down there, but I happened to find some people to take me down. And there's just millions of skulls. And so
millions
of skulls. And so you're able to see specifically the one spot where we went to was these were skulls from people who died during a cholera epidemic in the late 1800s. And so we were able to look at their jaws, to look at their mouths, look at their faces. And this was right at the height of industrialization in Europe, where people just started eating processed foods. And within a single generation, mouths shrunk, sinus cavities shrunk, faces started changing. So you could see that very, very easily in the skulls. And, you know, I'm an amateur inspector of skulls, and I certainly was at that time, but you can still see it. This was a way for me to get my hands on some skulls without going through labs, without getting permission, really. But, you know, that section of the book repeatedly was cut from the book. My editor said, "What? This doesn't make any, this is a book about breathing. And now you're 60 feet below Paris and you're crawling through these, you know, tunnels for 4 hours." But I thought it was important to show that the proof of this crazy assessment that the human body has changed is all over the place. It's below us. It's above us. It's all around us. It's in the mirrors. It's on the internet. So it was a way for me to personally experience what I have been hearing from so many of these experts.
Just amazing, really. It shines a light on, I mean, I read this and then I start to think of people I know and people who've had tremendous problems, either dental or breathing. I mean, so many people breathing. I mean, sleep apnea is crazy, right? Mm-hmm. And never considered any of this. Never. And then I'm, yeah.
Yeah. And what's even scarier to me, and I never had either, by the way. So this was a process of discovery, writing this book was. I never heard of any of this stuff. I was told that crooked teeth are hereditary. You get them from your parents. If you look on the NIH website, they say crooked teeth are hereditary. That doesn't make any sense if our great, great, great grandparents had perfectly straight teeth and our teeth were all messed up. So something like sleep apnea is, you know, 20% of the population is struggling with this. Sleep apnea can lead to diabetes. It can lead to Alzheimer's. It can lead to so many, it can lead to increased risk of stroke, to heart disease. I mean, this laundry list of awful things. We have CPAPs now, which work for the symptoms. They do nothing for the core problem. And the core problem for many of us is a mouth that's too small for your face. Obesity and being overweight definitely affects it. But sleep apnea and crooked teeth are mostly preventable problems. And people have a hard time dealing with that. People want to blame things on genetics, but these are preventable problems, as are the majority of modern diseases right now affecting Western cultures. If you start to look at them, you start to realize that our ancestors are certain hunter-gatherer cultures that still exist, the few that still exist on the planet right now, they don't suffer from these problems. So what went wrong and how do we fix it? And that's really what fueled me during this process.
Fantastic. So have you seen evidence of using breathing techniques to actually get people out of the CPAP machine for sleep apnea?
All the time.
Really?
You don't hear about it too often. Mm-mm. And here's another thing with it is not everything is going to work for everybody, right? So the great thing about palliative medicines, about tranquilizers, is they work for everyone in the same way. But some people have problems with their noses, right? They have a severely deviated septum. They can't breathe out of their noses, so they breathe through their mouths. Some people have a problem with the back of their throat. Their mouths are too small. They choke on themselves. Some people have anxiety issues. And so it really depends what the problem is on to how you address it. The great thing is about these breathing techniques is there are only benefits from them. So at the end of a few weeks of doing them, you might say, oh, okay, my sleep apnea isn't entirely gone, but my God, do I feel better? Wow, my blood pressure went down. I'm a lot calmer. But to your point, there is a huge upturning right now in sleep medicine, looking at breathing and looking at how just the way you breathe affects your incidence of the apnea hypopnea index, your AHI, which anyone with sleep apnea will know about this. And I'm talking with University of Penn in a couple of weeks. I talked with the Yale and Harvard sleep medicine departments. I talked with Stanford. So this stuff is very hot now because people are looking for real answers. They're not just, they don't want to wear this terrestrial, you know, scuba mask every single night. They want to understand the core problem. And a lot of that information that I've found has just been, I won't say covered up, but it's been clouded over by so many other interventions. And I think if you look at the core problem and address the core problem, you're going to have a much better, more durable way of dealing with this issue in the future.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, everybody, of course, we're going to have all this information in the show notes, links to James, not just the book, his website, where there is you leading some of these breathing practices. So I'm taking myself as an example of somebody who got the message and then let it just dissipate for whatever reason, maybe not paying enough attention to the body, paying more attention to the quote unquote spiritual consciousness effect. And then I get the book and something just went like this, James. And it was what I needed to hear to actually start to become more serious about putting this stuff into effect. And here it goes. A last word on slow breathing. And of course, there's many different prescriptions on different practices, which you get the book and you'll see them all. We'd have to do about 5 podcasts here to cover all that. And you say, it goes by another name, prayer. When Buddhist monks chant their most popular mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, each spoken phrase lasts 6 seconds with six seconds to inhale before the chant starts again. The traditional chant of Om, the sacred sound of the universe used in Jainism and Hinduism and other traditions, takes 6 seconds to sing with a pause of about 6 seconds to inhale. And that is the prescription. And talk about what, 5.5 seconds is, and that whole thing of the reality of how that gets represented in ancient cultures and spiritual traditions, having nothing to do with doing it because you want to lower your blood pressure, right? Just talk about that for a minute.
And yet how many cultures have known that prayer heals, right? Mm-hmm. And there's been studies confirming that, scientifically validating it. So about 20 years ago, some Italian researchers wanted to understand this a little better. And they realized that so many ancient prayers, from Native American prayers, Hawaiian prayers, Buddhist prayers, Hindu prayers, Christian prayers, locked into this respiratory rate of about 5 to 6 breaths per minute, which is about a 5 to 6 second inhale, 5 to 6 second exhale. It doesn't matter if you're a half a second off, you know, these are generalities here. Yeah. And they brought in a bunch of subjects and they covered them with sensors and they looked at what happened to their bodies when they recited these prayers, be it Om or the Catholic prayer cycle of the Rosary. These are Italians, of course, so I'm sure they picked that one off to begin with. And they noticed that when people recited these prayers, they locked into that respiratory rate and they noticed something else, that their heart rates lowered, their blood pressure lowered, and their bodies entered this state of what they called coherence, where everything is working at peak efficiency. We don't want to breathe too much. We don't want to breathe too little. We want to provide our bodies with the optimum amount of air and energy at all times. And that's what prayer allowed us to do. So we didn't have stopwatches back then. We couldn't put up an app and say, breathe in to 5, breathe out to 5. But we had prayer. And the Italian researchers wondered, like, was it a coincidence that all of these prayers, all the most popular prayers around the world, various cultures over various millennia, all locked into this respiratory rate? They didn't think so. They think that this was a way of cultures to getting people to get people to breathe in this certain way. Because when you breathe in this certain way, the body is able to naturally heal itself so much more efficiently. And the good news is today, you don't have to pray. If you want to, that's fantastic. But you can just breathe at this rate and you will be able to share in these benefits. And this breathing pattern, this coherent breathing, has been thoroughly studied. Even brain scans, EEG studies, you name it. And it's been shown to be so effective in treating things like depression, anxiety, sometimes high blood pressure, even though it doesn't work for everybody. And, you know, it's something that is free for everybody. No one can charge you to do this. And there are only benefits associated with it. Mm.
And in my case, the wonder of doing a mantra like Om Mani Padme Hum or others that we know, alongside of this is, shall we say, makes it even more profound, because the doing of these mantras take you into a very specific vibrational place if you are free from attachment to outcome and all of that kind of thing. So now you get a twofer. You get that.
And we know that when you're, you know, when you're exhaling, you're vocalizing. And by vocalizing those vibrations, right, Om or Om Mani Padme Hum or whatever, that will stimulate the vagus nerve, which sends signals throughout the body to relax, to enter that parasympathetic state. Mm. So vocalizing is, there are a whole separate load of benefits from doing that. But if you're not able to vocalize, if you're in the public, if you're walking around, you're in a restaurant, you can just breathe at this rate. No one will know you're doing it. And yet you can instantly feel these changes happening in your body. And if you don't trust yourself that these changes are happening, get a heart rate variability monitor. Get a blood pressure a measurement before and after doing these for a few minutes. And I think you'll see a big difference. Mm.
And why not go to the restaurant? It'll benefit everybody.
Fine with me. I would love to. I'd love to go to that restaurant. So sign me up.
Yeah, really. So there's a lot of great stories in here, which keeps it entertaining and not in the least bit dry. In the 30s, so there's a man named Kelder, right? It's mm-hmm. Peter Kelder, right? And how you found him, I have no idea. But I loved the story, and I wanted to say something about what you said, actually. Do you want to tell the story of Kelder with Colonel Bradford?
Sure. So this was somebody who was sitting on a park bench in LA, and this colonel came up, and he was very old. And this was what, in the 30s, I believe. He's very old. And this colonel was a British colonel, and he had just come back from India and said, "Hey, you know, I'm very old. My body's falling apart, but I've heard of this place that there's these monasteries and they can teach you these methods of regaining your youth. It's like this Shangri-La place." And so Kelder was just like, "Whatever, dude." So the guy hobbled off and came back 4 years later, and he looked completely reborn. Like, his hair color had changed. He wasn't limping anymore. He looked 20 years younger. And so Kelder then wrote a book called The Eye of the Revelation is the original title. And he renamed it after that. It sold something like 2 million copies. So
what?
pretty popular book. Wow. But it was a bunch of, and it's like, you know, 40 pages long too. So I'm glad that worked out for him. But it's just a series of yoga poses called the Five Tibetan Rites. And if you practice these, some people believe that they can help restore the body. So all it was is a series of stretches and breathing techniques to engage your diaphragmatic movement, to loosen up your rib cage so you can take in easier breaths. And, you know, that's one of many stories. And that book, that the new title is escaping me right now, but it's off.
We're going to find that. We got to find it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get that. I wonder if it's possible to even get a copy of it under the new title. That'll be interesting.
Yes, you can.
You can. Okay, yep. Let's do it. That would be fun. But what you say in it, is Kelder's yarn was likely fabricated or grossly exaggerated. Well, I have to tell you, there is a practice that you probably know, but I unfortunately cannot. I tried to remember the name and looked it up. I couldn't find it anywhere. But it's a practice that yogis use. They go in with herbs into a solitary place for at least a year. And they actually get new teeth, new this, new that, and come out pretty much a new person. And I have to tell you, I actually met somebody who did that. And we know that we only know about the legitimacy of this character, this Baba in India, because he had hung out with Neem Karoli Baba, you know, Ram Dass, our guru, man in the blanket, in his very earlier part of last century. And they had gone around and done austerities together, meditating in caves and all that stuff. And he knew stories that he told us, this Baba. I used to travel with, and he had another Maharaji, we called him, had another name before that. And it was verified because Maharaji told the same exact story to our mentor, K.C. Tiwari, who told it to us. And when he heard this, he was flabbergasted. And this, he went through a transformation. And we'll try and find out the name of that. I will get to it. I know my friend Krishnas knows the name of that. But yeah, so maybe it wasn't a grossly exaggerated thing, you know, who knows, right?
Well, there's no way of knowing now. Colonel Bradford was a pseudonym for this person. He didn't list his real name, and Kelder's been passed away for years and years. And this was back in the 30s. But what is inspiring is all these other tales, which we had been warned were apocryphal, that they couldn't be true, that a human body couldn't do that. We found out that they are true and that humans can do this. Tummo is a great example. The concept that you can sit in the snow for 8 hours at a time and melt a circle around yourself. This is what Buddhist monks had to do in the coldest nights of winters as part of their training. And they had been doing this for thousands of years. But when Westerners went out there and came back in the 60s, said there's these monks and they can heat their bodies up and they don't wear anything. They sit in the snow. Like, no scientists believe this. Nobody would believe this until a scientist went out there, a scientist from Harvard named Benson. Herbert Benson, right? Yes. Yeah. And found out that these monks were not able only to do that. They were able to decrease their metabolic rates by 60%, well below someone in a coma, and heat themselves up simultaneously. What is the scientific explanation for that that we have? Zero. We still don't know how they're able to do it. And yet we know that they can do this. And breathing is an essential part of this process. So that's where I think things get very interesting, where you can measure the effects of these things, but still you hit this wall in our limited understanding of how the body really works, of how the universe really works, of how nature really works. And that's where science and measurements to me really get fascinating. That's the area I try to plumb into as much as I can.
Yeah. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, of course, has been working with the likes of Richie Davidson and others, our friend Danny Goleman, and exactly to show the substantiality of what they have learned over these years, where there was nothing else of interest except going inside and knowing what the what's this all about? And the fact is that these things are being proven out. I mean, I love the thing. There's a one Lama named Mingdur Rinpoche. I'm not sure if you know who he is. Yeah, you know who he is. And he was the first that they experimented on using all of the scientific measurement stuff. And this is so great. I mean, he had been practicing meditation for a long time, but he was relatively young when, I mean, he's not much more than, I don't know, 45, 6, 7 at this point. And this is at least 10 to 15 years ago when they did those first tests. And they said, okay, get into a compassionate moment. And they figured, okay, well, he's got to go in and just relax, use breath, whatever he might be. Instantly, they looked at it and they went, oh my God, he just instantly did that. So the capability that is being proven that we have, and through these amazing beings, these Tibetan monks in particular, is extraordinary. And you of course point this out, as you just did. But the interesting, so you bring in the whole Tummo thing, inner fire breathing. And you talk about Naropa, right? The sage who was elemental to what Tibetan Buddhism is today. And going through, and Herbert Benson doing all of that work he did to verify this stuff, all the way to Wim Hof. And I'm supposing, and you went into that, talk about Wim Hof and the way that he is using some of the stuff that we're talking about, and how it relates to sort of a more modern take on it, right?
Well, Wim is just another person in the long lineage of people who have been able to use their breath to do quote unquote impossible things. And if Wim were around 200 years ago and we were reading stories about his feats, nobody would believe it. I mean, this is just what's happened time and time again. The great thing about Wim is he is living right now in the modern age, and we have videotape and we have audio and we have scientific measurements. And so the fact that he's broken 26 world records, the fact that he sat in an ice bath for 2 hours and not suffered from frostbite or hypothermia, or that he can instantaneously turn on his brain to release opioids and other hormones into his body, this is all documented. And what's even better about this is that they've found in various studies that Wim can take a group of people, train them in his method, and then after about a week of training, they'll be able to take conscious control of their autonomic nervous system functions and their immune function. And this was proven when they shot these people up with E. coli, with the endotoxin version of E. coli, and they did not suffer any of the side effects that always come with E. coli. So this thing is just starting to really open up right now, and it's very exciting to see these breathing methods, this temporary exposure to cold, different conscious meditation methods being used for quote unquote incurable diseases. These people who were told that they were afflicted with something that will never be cured are walking out a couple months later, cured. And, you know, the scientific establishment is still trying to figure out how exactly that works, but you can't deny that these people are curing themselves. So again, there's that gray zone. We see the effects of these processes and techniques. We know they're working because we can measure that in their inflammatory markers and so many other markers. But we have a hard time understanding exactly what's happening to the body at that time. But we do know that breathing is an essential component of this healing process.
Mm, yeah. And that not, and you do mention, of course, you're talking about anxiety and panic, and we're talking about what's gone on in the last year. To use this methodology in the, in that way is, I think, one of the most important acts that anybody can do these days is really use your breath to really treat what has been, that's endemic. I mean, we can talk about people, 20% with sleep apnea, 20% with this, that, or the other, but let's get into, I think, a very high percentage over this last year in terms of the kind of anxiety that has been produced, not just with the pandemic.
I was talking to Dr. Belisa Vranich. She's written a few books on breathing, on the practices of breathing, more focused on structural aspects of how to breathe in a healthy way, how to stretch your body, how to position your body. So she deals with a lot of people with anxiety, depression, other mental health issues. And she said that you cannot ever truly help people overcome anxiety, panic, and more without first having them understand and take control of their breathing. Mm. You can blunt the symptoms of that, which we have drugs to do that, which aren't very effective if you look at the scientific literature. But, you know, we can numb ourselves, but you're not dealing with a core issue. And for so many of these people, the core issue is tied to the way in which they're stressing themselves out day in and day out with their breathing. And we can see a part of that by looking at their carbon dioxide levels. So when we breathe too much, we blow off too much CO2. And populations of people with asthma, with panic, depression, even anorexia, traditionally have very low CO2 levels, because they're breathing way too much and they're breathing through their mouth. And when you're constantly breathing this way, you're sending a signal to your body that it is constantly stressed. Even if you're not, even if your brain is calm, it's getting signals from the body saying that you are stressed. And people do this all day, every day. And after a while, it will just wear your body down, which is exactly what we're seeing right now.
Yeah. Not to mention here, up to 80% of office workers, according to one estimate, suffer from something called continuous partial, this caught my attention, partial attention. We'll scan our email, write something down, check Twitter, do it all over again, never really focusing on any specific task, multitasking. In this state of perpetual distraction, breathing becomes shallow and erratic. Sometimes we won't breathe at all for half a minute or longer. The problem is serious enough that the National Institutes of Health has enlisted several researchers to study its effects over the past decades. And one of these, Dr. Margaret Chesney, said, told you that the habit, also known as email apnea, holy Jesus, can contribute to the same maladies as sleep apnea. That's, I can relate with that. It's scary. I mean, in my my regular day-to-day world of doing this stuff and podcasts and podcast network and then foundation that related to Ram Dass and everything that we do. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on, and I'm proud of the fact that I can multitask and keep it all into little pockets, like I've got a little helmet on that, you know, like a VR thing. And then I read something like this and I go, are you out of your fucking mind? Jesus God, you know, a little bit scary. But then we go back to the Bhagavad Gita. And you talk about the translating the breathing practice of pranayama. So that is the thing that we who have spent a lot of time in the East, it's the first thing we came across related to anything around breath. And as I said, in the last number of years, that's been something that, again, it wasn't top of my list. And so I was a little bit going in and out of it and so on. But yeah, tell about your own us about your findings around pranayama and the yogic tradition. And I know you went to South America. Can't remember which country to see this person who was a devoted hatha yogi. What was his name?
Mm-hmm. DeRose.
Yeah.
So with email apnea, you know, this was something we could just go back to that for a second. So this was something that I thought that percentage was way overinflated. I said, there's no way 80% of us suffer from this, until I started wearing some sensors, a pulse oximeter and other instruments, and was looking at my breathing throughout the day. And it was so dysfunctional. When you sit down, you're like, oh my God, I've got 40 emails. I got to get back to all these people within the next hour. Someone's calling me. Your breathing just goes to hell. And this is when you need your breathing the most, because again, we get most of our energy from our breathing. And if you're not breathing efficiently, your body has to struggle. And when you are stressed, you really want to be able to operate at peak efficiency. So my breathing was way worse than I ever imagined. And I've heard this from so many people, and the science is very clear on this as well. Margaret Chesney is up at UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, very close to my house here. And she had been studying this for about 20 years. You know, some people hold their breath too much. Some people breathe too much. And it's a very real thing. And then you take compound into that the stress of sitting in front of a computer all day, with how we're sitting all day. And even if we want to take a deep fluid breath, so many of us are so hunched over that we can't. We're inhibiting more than 30% of our ability just to take a breath of air. So all of this, along with the anatomical changes that have occurred to our mouths and faces, is really created a perfect storm of chronically terrible breathing across the board. Even if you're an athlete, you're like, oh, I'm a perfect BMI and I'm super fit. These people can suffer from terrible breathing problems, which will wear themselves down. You know, if you look at weightlifters, even you think this guy's the pinnacle of health. He's all oiled up, lifting weights, super strong. Those guys die all the time in their 40s or 50s from heart failure because they can't breathe. Because they built up their neck so much that they can't breathe. And they suffer so often from sleep apnea. So, you know, these are big percentages to throw out. These are big claims to throw out. And I did not throw them out lightly. I did the research. And this is what the leaders in the field have told me. And all you have to do is look at the percentages of breathing pathologies and problems out there. And you can see it for yourself. So luckily, you know, the ancients were onto this stuff. For thousands of years, they knew of the importance of breathing, whether in Hinduism or Buddhism or Catholicism, I mean, whatever have you. And so that was fun to go and dig up some of that stuff and talk to people. DeRose was one person who's done an incredible amount of research in this work. You know, I went to India. This was years and years ago. I didn't find much. I'll be honest. A lot of Indians don't know what pranayama is. They don't know what Ayurvedic medicine is. They don't really care about what yoga is. And so it seems a bit ironic, but I went to Brazil, to somebody who's spent 30, 40 years digging through ancient texts to try to unearth the original yoga. And that's what he believes he has put together. Hmm.
Does he have a book or anything, DeRose?
There's tons of books. They're all in Portuguese. Really? Some of them are getting translated into English now. Fascinating guy, because he did not set out to look up this research for any specific reason. He just kept finding holes in the versions of yoga and pranayama that we've been taught in yoga classes. He said, all this stuff is new. Vinyasa flow, which I'm sure a lot of people do, I certainly do, that's 100 years old. And we accept that as this ancient practice of yoga. It's not. So DeRose wanted to find the original yoga, and the original yoga that started something like 5,000 years ago was a technology of breathing. That's it. There were no moves. There was no standing up, no downward dogs. You sat and you breathed and you used your mind. And so that's what yoga was first intended to do, is to put you up the ladder of self-realization.
But didn't he at some point, there were postures, but they would get into the posture for a very long time using breath? Is that not?
That's right. So the very first yoga, there were not postures. And then slowly, the yogis started developing mudras. They started developing asanas. They started developing different ways of holding their body. So the postures were originally meant to be held for an excruciatingly long time. Because when you're holding your posture like this, with your arm over your head, and you're breathing slowly, you are expanding your lung capacity, right? And so you're allowing yourself to breathe more easily. And that's what the DeRose method, he calls it, that's what it does. And again, as I mentioned, only 120 or so years ago did we start moving postures from one to the other in this kind of dance. That's not the original yoga. So it's just interesting that that original traditional yoga had been around for thousands and thousands and thousands of years and practiced in pretty much the same way throughout much of that time. But only in the past 100 years or so has it changed so much. And the version taught down the street at me at the zillion of yoga studios, you know, is this flowy yoga? Nothing wrong with it. It's great. I love it. I do it all the time. But I was more curious to see, you know, what are the origins of this practice, and how does breathing tie into it? And DeRose was able to really educate me in that regard.
That's good. Well, we've got to try and find something that's translated. We'll have everybody take a look. Back to the Shiva Swarodaya. This was developed 1,300 years ago, is what you have here, and it's kind of a very poetic thing, right? I mean, this one nostril open to let breath in, as the other will softly close throughout the day. Some days the right nostril yawns awake to greet the sun. That's so great. Almost. Other days the left awakens to the fullness of the moon. I love this stuff. These rhythms are the same throughout every month, and they're shared by all humanity. It's a method our bodies use to stay balanced and grounded to the rhythms of the cosmos and each other. I don't know what you're, this to me was, although not a lot said about it in the book, it was very meaningful, most especially around the idea of becoming balanced and grounded to the rhythms of the cosmos and each other.
Well, what's so great about this particular example, at least what I thought was so interesting about it, is it has been scientifically validated. So yogis were talking about this, you know, more than 1,000 years ago. They said, wait a second. Seems like our nostrils are all opening on one side at the same time, and then they're closing, and then the other side is opening. And of course, modern Westerners say, oh, this is impossible. What is this stuff? Doesn't make any sense. But it wasn't until 1895 that a German researcher found that the human nose, both sides of the nostrils, operate in these different systems, okay? So they will inflame, one side will inflame and block off one nostril as the other opens. And then as that other opens, after about 30 minutes to 3 to 4 hours, that will close and it will shift. And so for decades, researchers thought, why would the nose do this? This is such a waste of time. Until we started measuring it, and we found that inhaling and exhaling breath through different nostrils affects the body in different ways. The left side's associated with a calming effect, right? It lowers heart rate, it lowers blood pressure, cools us down. Right side is associated with a heating effect. It raises our heart rates and our blood pressure and affects our brains too. So it, to me, this is what makes this stuff so fascinating. It's not just the ancient text that the ancient text was writing about this, but then you can look at it now and apply it to our day and age and to find that it actually works. And there was at least one study where they studied a whole group of people and had them measure what nostril was open at what time. And at the full moon and new moon, they were all aligned at the same time. So cool.
Oh,
and that's exactly what the ancient texts had said. But these kind of studies, you know, I'm surprised someone was even able to do that. There's no money to do studies like this. And so there's no incentive for a lot of researchers. They can't get funding. But that's not, to me, that's no reason not to do this research. I think it's fascinating. And it's a way to better understand our bodies and our connection with our breath and everything around us.
Yeah. And consciousness. Mm-hmm. Okay, everybody out there, if you haven't heard enough that would make you go, wait, I should maybe just get a little bit of a shift of perspective, which is what happened to me through this book. And I thank you for that, James. And of course, we're going to provide everything we possibly can to allow you all to investigate a little bit more. And this has been highly eye-opening from the moment that I started reading this in preparation to have a chat with you. And it's resounding through my day. I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking, is there any mouth breathing that I'm doing? Okay, now I've got an opportunity. I'm going off for a walk and I can practice some of what we're talking about, not to mention, incorporating into regular daily practice. So again, thank you. Really, really appreciate it. And hope to speak to you again one of these days. So everybody, this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and catch all of the wonderful people that we have as part of this network, from meditation teachers to thought leaders to poets and experts on Rumi, Omid Safi. If you like Rumi, we have this wonderful podcast from a man named Omid Safi, who's just an expert on Sufi poets. It's really wonderful. So we shall see you next time on Mind Rolling. Again, thank you so much, James.
Thanks a lot for having me.